Prologue. The Arrest. I began comparing Judy Mikovits to Joan of Arc. The scientists will burn her at the stake, but her faithful following will have her canonized. Dr. John Coffin. Friday, November 18th, 2011. Is Dr. Judy home? I'm Jamie. I'm a patient, and she knows me very well. She'll remember me. She said to come by any time. That's odd, Mikovits thought. Patients rarely showed up at her door. The only Jamie she could think of was miles across the ocean in Hawaii, hardly a place one comes from unannounced. That's okay, David. I'll take it, she said. She swept past her husband, giving him a quick glance to indicate everything was okay as she walked to the door of her Southern California beach bungalow. Judy often wondered what David must think of her crazy life. Did he know he was signing up for a roller coaster ride when they married? She might be the world-famous rock star scientist, but he was the rock. As a teenager growing up in Philadelphia, Judy's husband David Nolde had danced on Dick Clark's American Bandstand to musicians such as Sam Cooke, Neil Sedaka, and the Everly Brothers. In his professional life, he had been a personnel manager for various hospitals. He was the kind of man who was good at listening, understanding people, and diffusing tense situations. She was often called the brilliant one, but it was David who understood what others tried to keep hidden. The woman standing at the door was tall and dark-haired, dressed in black. "Hi, Dr. Judy," the woman said. "Do you remember me?" Judy Mikovits had her Ph.D. in biochemistry and molecular biology from George Washington University and was an AIDS and cancer researcher of more than 30 years. But people often said she had a second career, a calling in the language of her strong Christian faith, as a patient advocate. Over the years, she had run volunteer cancer support groups and would often research and review treatment options for people and accompany them on doctor visits. Most people were terrified to be suddenly thrown into the medical system and were reassured by having someone along who understood the science. She also found that the majority of doctors welcomed the opinion of a researcher, as they often complained that they didn't have time to keep current with the latest research. Most people she helped referred to themselves as her patients, even though she was not a treating physician. In the past few years, she had moved from cancer research into a high-profile investigation of myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome, MECFS, taking the position of research director at the startup Whittemore Peterson Institute for Neuroimmune Disease, WPI, housed at the University of Nevada, Reno, UNR, campus. Mikovits developed the entire research program that culminated in an article in 2009 in the highly prestigious research journal Science, showing an association between a newly discovered human retrovirus, XMRV, xenotropic murine leukemia virus-related virus, and MECFS. There had been a partial retraction of the work a month earlier, but for many reasons, Mikovits still believed the theory was sound and needed rigorous validation. Over the past 5 years, Mikovits had counseled ME-CFS patients in much the same manner as she had counseled cancer patients, and felt she could tell pretty quickly if a person was suffering from the disorder. Patients were often unnaturally pale, sometimes too thin or overweight in a sickly way, and there was something about the eyes that looked different. She understood that calling what these patients suffered from fatigue was like calling the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima fireworks. Over a spectrum of severity, Many of the most severely affected spent 23 hours a day in bed with the shades drawn because of their utter weakness and light sensitivity. Many of the patients had been active, vital people before their affliction struck, with a good number engaging regularly in rigorous athletic pursuits, like running marathons or long-distance cycling. Their physical breakdown was often looked upon by doctors as some sort of unconscious psychological disorder, as if these people who lived life to the fullest had simply decided that life was no longer worth the trouble. But the disease was without mercy, lasting for decades and taking decades from patients' expected lifetimes. The former chief of viral diseases for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, claimed the level of disability in many of these patients was similar to terminal AIDS patients and those in end-stage renal failure, so patient comparisons to a living death were apt. But the years generally did not bring death, although an unusual number of patients developed rare types of cancers, salivary gland tumors, or B-cell lymphomas. This fact, more than any other, is what drew the former cancer and AIDS researcher toward this research. Why would years of a fatiguing illness result in an elevated rate of rare types of cancer? She felt there were some intriguing avenues to explore. Yes, Judy Mikovits had learned a great deal about ME/CFS in the past 5 years. Judy stared at the woman in her doorway and felt a sudden chill. She was certain the woman didn't have the disease and that she wasn't a patient she had ever seen before. "I don't know you," Mikovits said to the woman and began to push the door shut. Regan Harris first got to know Mikovits when she called the WPI in December of 2009 after reading the Science article. Regan was surprised and flustered to suddenly be speaking to an internationally recognized scientist, but Mikovits quickly put her at ease and asked Regan to share her story. With a deep breath, Regan began by telling Mikovits she had become sick in October of 1989. At the age of 14, after a bout of mononucleosis. The following year, she had been diagnosed with ME/CFS, and from that point on, life had been a roller coaster ride. Despite her ME/CFS, Regan had been able to graduate high school and had attended college where she received a bachelor's degree in psychology. While getting her degree, Regan researched the issue of suicide among the ME/CFS population and how these patients presented with a different psychological profile than people with depression. Regan's work eventually culminated in a poster presentation before a meeting of the American Psychology Society in 1998. After listening to Regan's tale, Mikovits told her about an ongoing research study and asked if she would like to participate. "I can never give you back the years of your childhood that were stolen from you," said Mikovits, "but I think we can prevent this from happening to other kids. Will you help me take this thing down forever?" Galvanized by Mikovits's confidence, Regan signed the forms and went to the grand opening of the $77 million WPI and Center for Molecular Medicine at the University of Nevada, Reno, in August of 2010. There she met Annette and Harvey Whittemore and their daughter Andrea, who had also been struck with ME/CFS from a young age. Regan couldn't wait to make her own contribution to this effort. Regan moved to Nevada in September of 2010. She planned on volunteering for the WPI, hoping it would lead to a paying job. Judy and David were warm and welcoming, often taking Regan out to sample the local cuisine. When Regan first arrived, David spent some time driving her around Lake Tahoe, eventually shuttling her to Glenbrook, the exclusive gated lakefront neighborhood where the Whittemores had one of their many residences. When David approached the gatekeeper at Glenbrook, the large gates opened, as he said, Whittemore. When they got to the Whittemore home, a historical residence known as the Lakeshore House, complete with its own private dock, David motioned with a hand and said, What do you do when your family is too big to fit in one house? You buy the one next door as well. The Whittemores owned two houses on Lake Tahoe. When Regan flew home to Massachusetts that Christmas, she couldn't wait to tell her mother all about her run-in with the Nevada royalty. Regan gushed about the wealth and influence of the Whittemores, noting, My God, they've even got a movie theater in their house. You would not believe this, Mom. Can you imagine what it's going to be like if I can work for them? It would be so cool. Regan's excitement was not fully celebrated by her New England mother, who said, Regan, I never want you to be seduced by money and power. You remember one thing. Anybody who is powerful enough to give you everything is also powerful enough to take it all away. Mikovits had almost latched the door when she heard a male voice shouting, Hold on there! A man, identifying himself as University of Nevada Reno campus security, stepped out from behind one of the large bushes in her yard and strode quickly to the door. Dr. Mikovits knew this man. He had investigated the robberies that had taken place at the WPI when she had been the research director, where she had been research director. That was in the past now. On September 29, 2011, she was fired, receiving the dismissal call on her cell phone from Annette Whittemore, president of the WPI, as she walked home. While the experience of being fired could shake anybody, how many could claim the news had been reported in the pages of the Wall Street Journal? The article by the well-respected journalist Amy Doxer Marcus in her health blog section of the Wall Street Journal had given a fair account of her firing. Whittemore told the health blog that she and Mikovits were not seeing eye to eye on who controlled the cells. Research on retroviruses and their possible connection to CFS, as well as other diseases, continues, she said. We will keep going down that path as long as it continues to show promise, Whittemore says. Annette Whittemore's given reasons for firing Mikovits would change several times over the ensuing months, but she detailed them in a letter sent to Dr. Mikovits on September 30, 2011, which, among other things, accused Dr. Mikovits of insubordination. On October 1, 2011, Dr. Mikovits sent a response to Annette Whittemore addressing the event that had ostensibly caused her firing, as well as more concerns she had about the management of the WPI. Mikovits told Annette that as the principal investigator on the National Institutes of Health, NIH, R01 grant, Mikovits alone was legally responsible for all resources on that grant, and that Mikovits alone was the one who should have decided the appropriate allocation of those resources. Mikovits was pleased that Annette hoped for a smooth transition regarding Mikovits's departure. However, as Mikovits was the principal investigator on three grants housed at the WPI, two from the NIH and one from the Department of Defense, DOD, she told Whittemore that she fully intended to continue her research on those same grants, but at another institution, once one was found. This is common practice in the scientific community. The principal investigator takes the grants with her if she leaves the institution. Her break 6 weeks earlier with the Whittemores had been sudden, but Mikovits was eager to move forward with her life and research. The next day, she was scheduled to fly out to New York City to participate in the celebration of a multi-million-dollar ME-CFS initiative to be run by ME-CFS physician Dr. Derek Enlender of Mount Sinai Hospital. Mikovits and Endlender were also scheduled to discuss ways in which they might collaborate after her departure from the WPI. But she would never make that trip. A thud at her feet made Dr. Mikovits look down. She realized the woman had dropped a microphone and a recording device. "That's illegal here," said Mikovits. "You can't record me without my permission." "We're just here to get your side of the story," replied the woman as she picked up the fallen items. "Fine then. You can come with me to my lawyer's office. I'm on my way to meet him." Mikovits again tried to close the door when three burly Ventura County Sheriff's deputies came around from the driveway. One of the deputies was brandishing a yellow piece of paper. "We have a search warrant." The deputies came onto the landing, pushed the door open, and proceeded to enter the house, pushing Mikovits's husband along with them. "David," she called out, "call the lawyer." Just that morning, she had called her attorney's office to ask if there were any warrants out for her arrest. On November 4th, the WPI had filed a civil case against her, claiming she left with intellectual property, specifically her notebooks and computer files. As a principal investigator on three government grants, Mikovits knew she was legally required to maintain and protect copies of all data under federal regulations and her UNR contract as an adjunct professor. In addition, since her research was being challenged by the scientific community, she needed to possess this information to defend the work. The attorney had found her trepidation humorous and said he didn't see anything that serious arising out of the civil case. Just to calm her, he had checked. There were no arrest warrants. But Mikovits still sensed something terrible afoot. She believed she had caused her former employers considerable distress. Viral Immune Pathology Diagnostic, VIPDX, a for-profit clinical lab loosely associated with the WPI and owned by the Whittemores and Lombardi, was selling an unvalidated diagnostic test for the XMRV retrovirus, one which they would later discontinue selling. They claimed that she had approved VIPDX's tests, including a new serological one announced under her name, when she was not employed by VIPDX and had not evaluated data or statements made by the clinical lab. Mikovits believed she had cut off a lucrative source of revenue for the WPI when she had vocalized all of this on September 23, 2011, at the Ottawa conference, saying, "VIPDX lab will not continue XMRV testing because it hasn't been shown to be reproducible in the blood working group, BWG. She was fired 1 week later. Others were already concluding the test was problematic after the release of the report from the BWG, the group founded to investigate whether the retrovirus posed a threat to the blood supply. Next came the replication study coordinated by Dr. Ian Lipkin of Columbia, one of the world's most famous virologists. A few days after Mikovits was fired, Lipkin had called to ask if she had confidence in the integrity of her former employers, the Whittemores, to allow her to perform the study in Reno. Mikovits told Lipkin that she did not have confidence that the study could be performed at the WPI. It was not until November 14, 2011, that Lipkin emailed Mikovits saying he had decided not to have the WPI participate in the study, a decision which would potentially cost the Institute a great deal of money. Despite these financial hardships to the Whittemores, Mikovits believed she was acting the only way she knew how, as an ethical scientist. The woman in black took Mikovits by the arm and motioned for her to come out onto the porch. "We just want to hear your side of the story," the woman repeated. Do you have any WPI property? I do not, Dr. Mikovits answered. Everything in this house is mine. She knew what they were looking for, the research notebooks. The notebooks, which she feared would have ended up on the bottom of Lake Tahoe, been altered, or otherwise kept from public view, had she not secured them. The open access to research, especially research funded by the government, was the property of all. She didn't have the notebooks, didn't even know where they were, but she knew they were safe. She believed that her assistant, Max Post, had secured them. Whatever she had discovered, or the mistakes she had made, the evidence would be there for all the world to see. Do you have a black laptop? The woman in black asked. Yes, it's sitting right on the table, but it's mine. It was a gift. From whom? Annette Whittemore. Mikovits remembered the extravagant 2007 Christmas party, the first WPI Christmas party, when Annette had presented her with the black laptop, a backup disk drive, and a printer. The only stipulation Annette put on her present was that Mikovits had to promise to back up the hard drive on the disk drive that stayed at the lab. Thus, as Mikovits understood it, there should be two copies of all data, one for the principal investigator, Mikovits, and one backed up on the drive at the lab. Annette even gave Mikovits the receipt for the computer in case there were any problems. The Whittemores were political contributors to U.S. Senator Harry Reid, a Democrat and the majority leader of the Senate, as well as many other politicians. All four of Harry Reid's sons had at one time worked for the law firm where Harvey Whittemore was a senior partner. In addition, Harvey Whittemore had personally helped advance the legal careers of two of Reid's sons, and one of the sons, Leif Reid, had become Whittemore's personal lawyer. In a 2006 article in the Los Angeles Times, Harvey Whittemore is quoted as saying, "You have to understand how close the Whittemore and Reid families are. My relationship with Senator Reid goes back decades." Harvey Whittemore was often identified as one of the most politically influential individuals in the state of Nevada, earning nicknames such as the 64th Legislator for his help in drafting the state's first business tax, and being among a select group of four wealthy men known as the Power Rangers, after the popular Saturday morning children's show. One reporter of Nevada state politics had quipped, "Governors come and go, but the Power Rangers stay the same." Ominously, one of Harvey's former associates said, "Harvey Whittemore has a different moral compass than the rest of us." One of the Whittemores' children, their daughter Andrea, had been struck down with ME/CFS when she was just 11 years old. Her parents were tireless in trying to find a cure for her, and through the work of Mikovits and others, Andrea, now in her 30s, was close to recovering her health. This personal connection to the disease made Mikovits believe that she and the Whittemores would always be on the same side. The case brought by the WPI against Mikovits was an unusual one, according to her civil attorney, Dennis Neal Jones. The complaint alleges what I guess you could call industrial espionage, and the defense is basically a whistleblower kind of defense. It was much different than the typical cases Jones handled. Both Jones and Mikovits's bankruptcy attorney, David Fallon, would be disturbed, however, by the legal maneuverings deployed against Mikovits. As attorneys, they understood the combativeness of the judicial system, but also knew there were rules and an expected logical progression of events. But this case seemed very different from the start in both the legal aspects and the response of the scientific community. It seems like the field was stacked against Judy, and it's continued to be so. Any allegations she was convicted of a crime or that there was a successful judgment against her is wrong, said Fallon. Judy is just an amazing person. She's probably one of the most brilliant people I've ever met. All Judy wants is fairness, and I can't understand how her profession can turn its back on such a talented individual who has so much to offer and could help so many people. When Mikovits thought about it later, she realized the problems had actually started soon after Mikovits and Annette Whittemore first appeared on a TV show in 2009 called Nevada Newsmakers, shortly after the publication of the landmark article in Science linking a new human retrovirus to ME/CFS. Mikovits and her team found evidence of the retrovirus in 68 out of 101 patients, 67%, with CFS, as compared to 8 out of 218, 3.7%, of healthy controls. As if it weren't enough that they were taking on a disease which had been looked upon for more than 30 years as some form of female hysteria, they were now planning to take on one of modern medicine's most controversial diseases, autism. "It's not in the paper, and it's not reported," Mikovits said, speaking hesitantly at first. "But we've actually done some of these studies, and we found the virus present in a significant number of autistic samples that we've tested so far." The show's host noted that this news had tremendous potential for the autism community, holding out the possibility that this might lead to treatments or even a cure. Mikovits replied by saying XMRV might be linked to a number of neuroimmune diseases, including autism. "It certainly won't be all, because there are genetic defects that result in autism, but there are also the environmental effects." Then, barely taking a breath, she crossed the Rubicon. "There's always the hypothesis that my child was fine, then they got sick, and then they got autism." Interestingly, on that note, if I might speculate a little bit, this might explain why vaccines lead to autism in some children, because these viruses live and divide and grow in the lymphocytes, the immune response cells, the B and T cells. So when you give a vaccine, you send your B and T cells and your immune cells into overdrive. That's its job. Well, if you're harboring one virus and you replicate it a whole bunch, you've now broken the balance between the immune response and the virus. So you could have had the underlying virus and then amplified it with that vaccine and then set off the disease, such that your immune system could no longer control other infections and created an immune deficiency. If these children were harboring a retrovirus, it wasn't an outlandish claim to make. It has long been established that children born to HIV-infected mothers shouldn't be immunized until they're on antiretroviral drugs and their tests show the virus to be at extremely low levels. As explained at the University of California at San Francisco webpage on HIV and immunizations, activation of the cellular immune system is important in the pathogenesis of HIV disease, and that fact has given rise to concerns that the activation of the immune system through vaccinations might accelerate the progression of HIV disease. These observations suggest that activation of the immune system through vaccinations could accelerate the progression of HIV disease through enhanced replication. If feasible, it is preferable to have patients on antiretroviral therapy, ART, prior to receipt of vaccination. Just as one wouldn't want an immunization to provoke AIDS in an HIV-positive child, one would also want to be sure a vaccination didn't trigger autism. Mikovits and Annette Whittemore had both grabbed onto the third rail of Western science, the question of vaccine injury and the increasing numbers of children with neurodevelopmental problems. The scientific community, often choosing comfortable yet unproven dogma over testing controversial ideas, made the funding of routine grant proposals even more difficult after the interview. The saga of Harvey Whittemore's Coyote Springs development had started in 1998, when he purchased 43,000 acres of remote Nevada desert about an hour northeast of Las Vegas. The dry landscape was originally considered to be so barren that its best use was thought to be a weapons test range. One reporter referred to the single outpost of civilization they'd been able to build on that godforsaken land as the golf course at the end of the world. But Harvey Whittemore had big dreams. He envisioned 10 golf courses as an anchor for retirees and hard-working families who wanted the good life but couldn't afford Vegas prices. In addition to the already built Jack Nicklaus signature course, there would eventually be 159,000 housing units. If fully realized, Coyote Springs would become the second largest city in Nevada. But it had all fallen through as the recession of 2008 started to take its toll and real estate markets across the country had bottomed out. As of 2011, none of the housing units had been built and only the single golf course had been completed. The writer remarked that Nicklaus's single green golf oasis in the dry brush country of jagged edges and steep lines made it look like a vista out of the classic 1968 science fiction movie, Planet of the Apes. And yet there was something audacious about Harvey Whittemore's ambitions, even in light of his troubles. The reporter who dubbed it the golf course at the edge of the world also gave what might be considered a eulogy for many of Whittemore's projects. After first writing that normally when one sees a development gone bad, you simply think the developer put his money in the wrong place and give a figurative shrug. The developer will go on to a new project. But a golf course, at least one made with such high levels of devotion and talent as this one, is different. "You're under arrest," said the woman in black, slapping a pair of handcuffs on Mikovits. "But it's my laptop," Mikovits protested. The police would take and hold for almost 1 year not only Mikovits's black laptop, but also her iPad, iPhone, the MacBook Air she had recently purchased for her Ireland trip, and the silver laptop of her stepdaughter, who had been staying with them for a few days. "Don't say anything," David called out. "I won't," she shouted back. 4 unmarked sheriff's cars immediately came around the corner from Harbor Boulevard, staging what might have looked to the casual observer like an episode of America's Most Wanted, rather than the apprehension of a figure in a scientific controversy. Mikovits, 5'4" of her, frizzy blonde hair, and just a shade over 140 pounds, stood on the road in her white jogging shirt and black knee-length shorts. She was shoeless, having left her flip-flops on the floor in the bathroom. One of the deputies noticed she was barefoot and asked if she had anything back at the house. "I was wearing my flip-flops," she replied. An officer went into the house to retrieve her shoes. "Why am I being arrested?" Mikovits asked one of the deputies. "You are a fugitive from justice." The arrest of Mikovits would confuse every legal expert who looked at the facts of this case for a simple reason. Nobody involved in any of these proceedings ever produced an arrest warrant. Under what law could a middle-aged scientist be taken into custody without an arrest warrant? The question would remain unanswered. A deputy returned with Mikovits's flip-flops, and she was able to put them on her feet. A sheriff's deputy opened the back door, and she was escorted into the squad car for the 8-mile drive to the Ventura police station. At the police station, she was taken to an interrogation room and read her Miranda rights by an officer. Yes, I want an attorney, and I'll remain silent, she told him. The woman who had identified herself as Jamie, now revealed as a member of the University of Nevada, Reno campus police, was also in the interrogation room. We'll give you a chance to go back to Reno, she said. One has to wonder how many times the UNR campus police have crossed the Nevada border to make an arrest of an adjunct professor in Southern California. Mikovits wondered if the whole song and dance had been an attempt to intimidate her so that she would agree to let the WPI participate in the Lipkin study, which would represent at least $250,000 for the WPI. Arrest her in her home, drag her back to Reno, and let her stew in a jail cell until she agreed to let the WPI back into the Lipkin study. And if she didn't agree, who knew what might happen to her in a Nevada jail cell? I'm never going back to Reno, Mikovits replied, as clearly as she could. We'll see about that. See ya, the campus cop sneered. After about 2 hours, Mikovits was taken to the Ventura County Jail, booked, and told to stand for a mugshot. They gave her a thorough strip search, including a body cavity search for drugs, took her only jewelry, her wedding band, her baseball cap, and her clothes, and issued her a standard prison orange jumpsuit. She tried to use her allotted phone call to reach David, but outdated regulations disallowed calls to a cell phone. The only landline number she could remember was that of her longtime collaborator, Dr. Frank Rossetti, back in Maryland. Nobody was home, so the machine at his house picked up the call. Instead of allowing Mikovits to speak, all that was left on the machine was a disembodied, robot-like voice saying, "You have a call from inmate." Later, Rossetti recalled having no idea what to make of the crazy message. Finally, she called a bail bondsman and tried to post the $100,000 bond which had been levied against her. The bondsman told her, with a tone of disbelief in his voice, that a bail hold had been placed on her case and she wouldn't be able to be released that day. "You must really have pissed off someone important," he said. "I never had a case where somebody was charged with stealing their own research," Bill Burns of 101 Bail Bonds later recounted. When a potential client contacted Bill, he usually performed a background investigation in order to get a sense of the person. Sometimes the people who found themselves arrested could be pretty smooth talkers, but their record usually told the real story. Burns talked to Mikovits's lawyer, who explained the nature of the dispute with the Whittemores, and then he did his own research. He was quickly able to find out she had no criminal history, that she was a well-regarded scientist, and her husband, David Nolde, had also never been in trouble with the law. A picture of his new client began to form in his mind. He had seen a similar scenario several times before, whether it was an overzealous district attorney unfairly prosecuting somebody, or when a wealthy individual had influence and knew how to make another person's life miserable. The information he gathered about Mikovits in a short period of time convinced him that something was definitely out of whack. A lot of people suffer from this illusion of how great our legal system is, Burns later recounted, and it really isn't great. You talk about third world countries, you could feel like you're in a third world country when you're locked up and trying to get out. You can't use the phone. You don't have the ability to mount a defense. It's amazing in a country of this size that a lot of people get screwed very badly in our system. It's very easy to end up losing everything on a case that shouldn't have even been brought. Determining if a potential client was trustworthy was important to Burns's business. Bail bonds don't get exonerated until the case is resolved, whether that takes 2 months or 2 years. The bail for Mikovits was $100,000, which meant she would put up 10% of that money up front. Burns would normally take a lien on her house or other property as collateral for the bond, But in this case, he didn't have Mikovits or David Noldy sign over anything as collateral. I did $100,000 on a signature because I thought not only was the case full of shit, but everything about it was wrong, he later said. There were three holding cells in the basement of the Ventura County Courthouse. The cells were 6 by 8 feet, with a 3-foot-long steel bench, a small wall, and on the other side a steel commode, unfortunately without any toilet paper. The guards would alternate which cell a new prisoner would be put in, usually about 5 to a cell. When it was full or the hour was late, the group of prisoners would be taken to the new Ventura County facility down the road. Many of the people in the holding cell were picked up that day for drug offenses or driving under the influence. For some of the prisoners, it was their appointment time to serve all or part of their sentence. These were people whose cases had already been heard, and due to the overcrowding of the jails and the relative minor nature of their offense, would serve just a few days. Shortly after Mikovits arrived in her cell, a woman named Karen, pseudonym, entered to serve her appointment time. She worked for a local newspaper, managing several of the vehicles which made early morning deliveries. She had been picked up on a minor drug possession charge, was convicted, and, as she told Mikovits, just wanted to put the mistake behind her and get it over with. Others were a little more frightening. One woman came in, teetering on 6-inch heels, her hair 18 different shades of the rainbow, clearly picked up for drugs. Karen and Judy exchanged thankful looks that she hadn't been put in their cell. As the hours passed, the cells continued to fill up, with some of them apparently regulars. They would warmly greet their fellow inmates or guards as they were processed in. At some point, one of the prisoners asked if any of them were first-timers. I am, said Mikovits. In the late evening, probably around 10 or 11, Ruth, pseudonym, a distraught woman in her mid-50s, was brought into the jail. She was coughing and crying at the same time and lamenting that this was all a mistake. In the 6 or 7 hours Mikovits had been in the holding cell, she had learned a little about jail psychology. One didn't look directly at people, and one kept one's head down. Everybody else was avoiding looking at Ruth as well. This is all wrong. This is a mistake, cried Ruth. I shouldn't be here. I should be home. Mikovits knew just how she felt. When Dr. Jamie Dekoff Jones read the October 9, 2009 science article by Mikovits and her team shortly after its publication, she looked up at her husband and said, "This is it. This is what we've got." Dekoff Jones was a graduate of Harvard and Albert Einstein College of Medicine and a board-certified emergency physician. Her father was a brilliant man and legendary surgeon who graduated magna cum laude from Yale and finished Harvard Medical School at the age of 21. Dekoff Jones traced the beginning of her own neurological downfall to a series of hepatitis B shots she received when she was pregnant with her third child. She also often wondered about the sugar cube polio vaccine she received in 1961. Her symptoms waxed and waned over the years, and she believed the constellation of her symptoms most closely resembled some sort of combination of Lyme disease and multiple sclerosis. Her daughter came down with ME/CFS when she was 13 years old, and around the same time her husband came down with Lyme carditis, a heart condition associated with Lyme disease. In January of 2010, she wrote to Mikovits and was amazed at the lengthy emails Mikovits wrote in response to her questions, as well as her openness and inclusiveness. As their relationship grew, Dekoff Jones took over the role of answering much of Mikovits's email questions from patients. It was Dekoff Jones's opinion that Mikovits was spending so much time responding to patient emails that it was limiting the amount of scientific work she could accomplish in a day. Dekoff Jones eventually came on as the clinical director of the WPI. Her relationship with the Whittemores quickly soured. Dekoff Jones believed the problems arose because of Annette's inability to admit what she didn't know and protect her staff. Eventually, Harvey took over as the person at the WPI to whom Dekoff Jones directly reported. She found Harvey to be a smart man and generally easy to work with, but he had his breaking point. In a text she sent to Harvey, she used the word nepotism to describe many highly placed individuals who worked at the WPI, like Carly West Kinney, legal counsel for the WPI, and Kellen Monick Jones, the patient coordinator for the WPI, both Whittemore nieces. Other examples included not just relatives, but others who had long-standing personal or professional ties with the Whittemores. "Now you've really lit my fuse," Harvey wrote back in a text after the nepotism comment. Shortly after that, Annette Whittemore informed Dekoff Jones that they were going to have to shelve their plans for a clinic and her services wouldn't be needed. They had had conflicts over other issues as well, such as whether the clinic should treat kids with autism. Dekoff Jones wanted to treat them, but believed Annette saw far too many problems with such an effort. For Dekoff Jones, Mikovits's story is important in that Mikovits was like Pandora, opening a forbidden box. "She made mistakes like everybody in the story. Me, everybody. An incredible opportunity has been lost as a result. But it's mostly Harvey and Annette's fault. Judy never had a chance. They never supported her. She didn't have what she needed to pull it off. Ever. It was a joke." Around 2 a.m. the day after her arrest, Mikovits was driven to the Todd Road facility located in a lemon orchard about 10 miles out of the city of Ventura. Upon being admitted to the facility, she was again required to strip, bend over, and submit to being cavity searched for drugs. Mikovits was given several pieces of paper with directions on how to be a model prisoner, but because she didn't have her reading glasses, couldn't make out the words. When she complained to a guard about her need for reading glasses, the guard replied, "This isn't a resort, that's why they call it jail." Apparently, a model prisoner didn't need to read. At one point during her processing, Mikovits was asked if she was suicidal. "No," she replied. Even with her clear answer, Mikovits was placed in the suicide watch wing. The suicide watch wing was regularly used for people who were being arrested for the first time. It seemed that being arrested and placed in jail for the first time was such an overwhelming experience for the average person that it was presumed to make them suicidal. The light in the suicide watch cell was on the entire night, which allowed the guards to constantly monitor the prisoners for any signs of abnormal behavior. Mikovits's cellmate was a woman, Marie, pseudonym, who was undergoing treatment for a methamphetamine addiction. Because Marie was taking several powerful drugs to break her addiction and was thus at risk of falling out of bed, Mikovits was required to take the top bunk. The cell was made of thick cinder block. The cell was about 4 feet wide, had a bottom and top bunk made of steel, a commode and sink attached to the wall, and a small window at the top. Instead of bars across the front entrance, there was a thick steel door with a small rectangular window. When the steel door closed, sealing her in, Mikovits felt as if she was in a tomb. The opening and closing of the heavy doors all night sent shivers through Mikovits. She could never have imagined herself in such a place. For a mattress, they were given the equivalent of an exercise mat and no pillow since they were in the suicide watch cell. Marie explained to Mikovits how to put her foot on one side of the small sink to climb into the top bunk. Upon making it to the upper bunk, Mikovits was greeted by the fluorescent oblong light, which never went off. Mikovits thought about one particular day in the WPI shortly after she had returned from the Invest in ME conference in England in May of 2011, when Harvey had stormed into her office. He shouted at her because he thought she had insulted Annette's efforts to reach out to another ME-CFS charity. Mikovits had done nothing of the sort, but Harvey demanded, "You're going to go and apologize to Annette." "Okay, okay," Mikovits replied, hoping to defuse the situation. Harvey's booming voice had no doubt been overheard by other staff members, but as they left Mikovits's office, he put on a big smile and slid his arm around her shoulder. But his hand didn't reach all the way to her shoulder, stopping instead at the back of her neck, where it would be concealed by her shoulder-length blonde hair. As he walked past employees of UNR, all smiles and friendliness, Mikovits felt his hand squeezing the back of her neck so hard she thought it would leave bruises. To Mikovits, the message was unmistakable. She felt like he was saying he could end her at any time he wanted, and all of these people he supported wouldn't raise a voice in protest. Harvey pulled the same little neck-squeeze trick on Mikovits in August of 2011, when they'd been leaving a restaurant with a representative of a drug company that Mikovits had introduced to the Whittemores. Harvey was hoping the company would initiate a clinical trial of a new drug therapy with the WPI and provide significant financing. Mikovits had been unusually quiet during the evening, and by the end of the meal the company had decided not to collaborate. Since that time, Mikovits had been plagued by a recurring nightmare in which she was driving with friends of hers, having a great time, laughing and talking, when Harvey Whittemore suddenly sat up in the back seat, reached his long arm around her neck, and started strangling her. The metaphor was clear. He could do anything to her, and she could not scream. That first night in jail, Mikovits didn't worry about her own safety. She believed that Harvey's plan had been to get her back to Reno, and she knew the notebooks containing evidence had been secured by Max. Who knew what was planned for her in Nevada? But no matter how long his arms, Mikovits doubted Harvey could reach all the way from Reno, Nevada to her jail cell in Ventura, California. It was ironic, but she felt safer in a cell with a recovering methamphetamine addict than she had felt in months. Mikovits let her thoughts wander to Dr. John Coffin, whom many saw as the grand old man of virology, and his quote in Science comparing her to Joan of Arc. "Science at the highest levels is a territorial game of power. In many cases, if a young person discovers a novel finding in someone else's turf, the self-appointed head of that domain writes the second paper and first review article and effectively squeezes the young person out." Coffin had actually written an editorial in support of her original article in the journal Science entitled "A New Virus for Old Diseases." Now he was on the other side. Who, Mikovits wondered, compared a fellow researcher to Joan of Arc, a 14th century warrior saint unjustly accused of heresy, and prophesied, "The scientists will burn her at the stake"? It was a ludicrous statement. Why should a scientist be burnt at the stake for publishing data that might turn out to be wrong? In the 1970s, many papers were published falsely claiming the discovery of human disease-causing retroviruses. None of these people were burnt at the stake. Some of them were elected to the National Academy. Was Coffin comparing the scientific community to the agents of the Inquisition? How might they feel about such a comparison? If her research turned out to be incorrect, let somebody else run the same experiments and disprove her. That was the way science went. People can be right one day and wrong the next. She could accept that. Coffin had been wrong about human retroviruses. Had he ended up in jail? Disgraced? No. There was so much more to this story. But as much as she thought Coffin had acted inappropriately in many instances, she also felt that a great many of her problems stemmed from her former allies, the Whittemores. She believed that the recession had badly hurt the Whittemores' real estate holdings, but also wondered if others with far more power might be forcing them to act against their natural inclinations. But why would anybody not be interested in helping the millions of patients with ME/CFS and children with autism? Even with all that had happened, as Mikovits lay in her bunk, she found herself trying to pray for the Whittemores. Mikovits had genuinely liked them. Many of her friends believed her downfall was due to her misplaced loyalty towards the Whittemores, maybe an emotional naivete, an inability to tell when people were manipulating her. But there was no doubt that since the 1984-1985 outbreak of ME/CFS at Lake Tahoe, no other individual or group had done more to focus attention on this horrible disease than the WPI. The poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow once wrote, "If we could read the secret history of our enemies, we should find in each man's life sorrow and suffering enough to disarm all hostility." It was in this vein that Mikovits thought of the Whittemores as she sat in her jail cell. Mikovits believed Annette was in over her head with the WPI, but she was a parent fighting for her child's life. She felt that so many things had conspired against them, but especially the economy, and not fully understanding how much the government wanted to avoid taking an honest look at ME/CFS or autism and the role vaccines might play. Mikovits tried to leave these thoughts behind and concentrate on something more elevated. She struggled to remember the words of certain biblical verses she had heard over the years at church, but couldn't recall any. It bothered her because she really wanted, needed, to pray. Only the words to the Lord's Prayer came to her. She began reciting it over and over, almost like a mantra, and it gave her a feeling of great peace as she faced the uncertain night ahead. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Act, and God will act, Joan of Arc had once said. Despite all the times she had acted before and it had come to nothing, Mikovits thought she would try once again.